Good morning. Welcome to Tamerlay's Trend On, engaging your audience to trend on you. I'm your host, Tamerlay, founder of Tamerlay LLC, a communications expertise company meeting the needs of clients on multiple communications platforms from mobile, social, and content to image and style consulting. You can check out my website at Tamerlay, TamerlayGHLLC.com. Tamerlay LLC, engaging your audience to trend on you. You can also follow me on Twitter at Tamerlay LLC. I want to thank you for joining me along with my co-host Heidi Feimster on the Link Local Network. And you can find out more about the show at thelinklocalnetwork.com as well. You can follow Heidi at Heidi Feimster. Heidi is the brains on and behind the show as co-host, producer, and tech STEM savvy gal and managing partner at Manditech LLC. So Tamerlay's Trend On is one of several excellent shows in the lineup on the Link Local Network, like the Empowerment Show with Melissa Heisler, Business with Ivor Kellogg from the UK, Segue to Success with Brent Hamachek and Tom Kuchin, and the Biz Buzz with Catherine Johns and Michelle Rempel, to name a few of our great LLN shows. Link Local Network is an organization of professionals who utilize social media to promote their businesses and accomplish their goals with a strong local, national, and international following. Link locally, connect globally. I should also quickly mention that you can find today's show link as well as those of the past Tamerlay's Trend On shows and blog posts on my website, Tamerlay LLC, as well as on the Link Local Network website under radio shows. So there is our business to get the show started, and today we have a very exciting show, timely for the week of Father's Day with great men. I posted on several of my social media platforms of good men. They often say good men are hard to find, but I was able to connect with two of them this week for our Trend On guests. We have Dan Cobby. Did I say that right, Dan?
Perfect. Said it perfectly.
Okay, good. And he is the founder and CEO of Digitaria. Did I say that right?
Bingo. Let me tell you, very few people can do back-to-back, Cobby and Digitaria. Very few people.
Ooh, okay.
Commend you.
We'll just stop the show right now. And then for the second half of our Trend On show today, we have Mark Papadas, who is the founder of I Am for Kids, an organization that works with kids in schools and different ways, communities, for building self-esteem in children. And as we all think about Father's Day, fathers certainly have probably the most crucial impact on building a child's self-esteem, and yet with so many broken homes and fathers under stress themselves, we just need help, and kids need other means for building their self-esteem. So Mark has done a great job with building an organization that provides that tools and resources to help kids really become what they want to be. And as one, our guest Dan was such a child with a stable home and great backstory to Dan's success. So I'm looking forward to talking about both of those topics with our guest today. But before we get into that, Heidi, do you have a shout-out to our sponsor?
I do.
We'd like to say hi, Heidi.
Hi.
I kind of missed you there and all that.
We'd
welcome
like
to our show, Heidi.
Yeah, thank you. We'd like to thank Mediavine Marketing, simplifying social media for successful businesses and professionals through training, consulting, and management. Mediavine Marketing, minimizing your efforts and maximizing your results. We'd like to thank Manditech, the Chicago area technology company that has the right solution for your business, increasing your visibility and profit with technology. We'd also like to thank ZipBoss.com, a professional business cloud built and maintained by Metasoft, Inc. ZipBoss, create, market, succeed, where powerful websites are born. Thank you, Tamara.
Thank you, Heidi. And we would also like to thank I Am Marketing, integrated mobile marketing, engaging your business on mobile devices in a way that they are able to find you and engage your business, walk to your door with call to action, click to call, maps, social buttons, and more, all visible on your mobile devices. So you can find out more information about that at Tamerlay LLC and at I Am Marketing. So, Heidi, do you have our business minute for today?
I do.
Thanks.
Last time we talked about why a company should implement ERP, that is Enterprise Resource Planning. It's a computer system and a software that helps run your company more efficiently. This week, we focus on some of the hows. How do you choose an ERP system? But before you can do that, you need to answer some questions. The first and foremost question is, do your organizational leaders support the ERP implementation project? It's very important. Without their support, it won't succeed. And if so, are they involved in deciding which business processes are included in this package? These are crucial questions because in order for ERP to succeed, executives throughout the organization must be a part of the process. The next question that must be asked, who are the professionals that can be responsible for measuring the benefits of ERP? Executives and employees beyond the IT department need to be part of the success of the ERP installation. The more the key players in the company are on board with the ERP plan, the greater the overall success of the ERP implementation and ROI. Next week, we will talk more about questions to ask before choosing an ERP system. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you, Tamara. Are you there? Uh-oh.
I am here. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
I was going to say thank you for that on ERP. So as we have lots of ground to cover on today's show, we would like to first, as I said, introduce our guest, Dan Cobby, who is the CEO, founder of Digitaria, based out of San Diego. And we were just talking off-air about how lucky Dan is to be in that perfect weather year-round. I think they call it San Diego sunny.
Although it is drizzling today, for the record, there's a little bit of drizzle, so the world's upside down here in San Diego today. So,
okay, we're not going to feel bad for you. It's been drizzling nonstop. but you're a Midwest boy, aren't you, originally?
I am. I'm born and raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So, local, Midwestern boy, Minneapolis boy, and then ended up out west because my older brother actually became the orthopedic surgeon for the L.A. Lakers, L.A. Kings, and L.A. Dodgers. So I'm a huge sports fan, and he promised me front row seats at the Forum. So right after college, I was in school back east. I headed out west and headed up and started my business career at San Diego.
Well, that is a nice big brother to have. And it would sound... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it would sound like from that that little bit of information you shared with us that you came from a family of privilege, but one of the things that caught my attention with you and how you came to be a guest on our show today was I read one of your very first articles on LinkedIn. Well, maybe it wasn't your first article, first one I saw, but you had me at the fashion because it was about tailor-made service. There it is. Thank you for that little help. And so I thought, oh, I like that being, a J. Hilburn custom luxury menswear style consultant. The tailor part caught my attention, and I write fashion blogs and things like that. And as I read that article, it just warmed my heart. So why don't you tell our audience the backstory to that?
Yeah, so essentially the backstory is I am on LinkedIn. I am what's called an influencer. And basically LinkedIn has spent a lot of effort and time allowing people to become content publishers. And so with that, kind of all the different, it ranges from a Barack Obama to, to a Tony Robbins to all different types of, folks on there. And I'm privileged enough to have the opportunity to, be able to kind of tell my story and tell my perspective. So it's allowed me to kind of restate and kind of rethink about my life and, what has been my impact, what has impacted me most and how have I been able to kind of, make it through everything. And I think that, really, when I think about some of my original stories, the first one was about kind of how to face your fears. And then the second one, I wanted to really think about, what are the things you can learn from your father? What are the things that make you who you are? And I think that at its core, your parents have such a huge influence on you. And I think that when you mentioned this whole idea, you mentioned before that you'd think I come from a place of privilege. And I would say that I do, because I come from a family full of love and full of care and full of confidence. And we didn't have any money, but we had the most important element, which was, you know, a sense of security and a sense of hope. And all those things are the elements that really made up our family. You know, I'm one of five kids. And when I think about my father, who, you know, came to the United States with nothing, you know, left Lebanon and had to become a tailor because he knew nothing else to kind of, there was no way he could get a business, didn't speak the language, but he understood he had to learn how to become a tailor. So him becoming a tailor, he learned how to meld his business knowledge that he gained in Lebanon and brought that to the United States and really, really helped create a great venue for guests and visitors. And I became a role player in that. I became very interested at a very young age to see what was my father doing downstairs in our home. And we had this, you know, very modest home. And then when you head downstairs, that was the place. That's where the show started. That's where my father essentially, you know, took on executives and really made them look great. And in return of that, I think from my perspective, I slowly started to learn, wow, through my life, I've been able to learn things from my dad at a very young age, things that he did with his customers. I've been able to bring that and modernize that today with my customers, or even be able to articulate and call it something. Like, for example, you know, one of the things that I learned a lot from my dad was this whole idea of value pricing. That fundamentally, that if you create something that people want, people will pay whatever the price is. So my dad created an environment within our home that was so intriguing and so interesting and so culturally stimulating, because they brought Lebanon to the Midwest, that clients and the people that he did business with, who are generally very wealthy Midwestern individuals,
yeah, didn't ask the question.
Yeah, they didn't ask the question, how much this costs. My dad would say, it costs X, and they never negotiated it. Not that my dad was ripping them off. He was fair in price. But they never asked the question. And I always wondered that. And the reason why was because he created such an environment that the value that they received was not necessarily looking great, but was looking great in an environment that made them feel great. So that's kind of that's the background of the story.
Yeah, and I was going to say, as I read that, because I've worked, you know, over a decade with immigrant families and helping them in that cultural adjustment process and the language acquisition. And that is often the case with immigrants, of where they're intelligent, they are accomplished professionals back in their home countries, but they come here, and because of some of those language barriers and cultural barriers, they have to find a different way than what they left. But, you know, coming here was so important to them, and usually there's that strong family, and I love the way you said that about a privilege, and truly it wasn't a monetary thing, but when people would think of that, they would think of that you had opportunity from a financial position, but really your privilege did come out of that context of your home and culture. So I think that's wonderful, and I didn't realize you were one of five kids. My youngest of five just graduated this weekend.
Yeah, I know. Congratulations. I am one of five. So, and you know, what's interesting is, you know, I think a lot about, you know, family and not just my father and father's, but just in general, because I think that without mentioning my mother alongside, you know, my dad, I think my mother was the driving force behind everything, right? So as much as my dad taught me lessons about success, my mom taught me lessons about drive. And I think that when you look at our family, where, you know, you can make an argument, we were five kids. If you run down the list, you know, my oldest brother, you know, went to Harvard Medical School. My other brother went to, you know, Brown University, then graduated at University of California, San Francisco Medical School. My sister is very big to fashion. She runs a showroom called Simon Showroom, and she was the number one distributor for Citizens Humanity Jeans all across the United States. And my little brother is an attorney. And it's funny because when I look at all of us and I reflect back on our life, I think that the combination of my mother and my father and the roles that they played were so tremendous and had such a big impact. And even today, you know, it amazes me. It just truly amazes me, the things that I continue to learn and uncover about, you know, my childhood and how that's impacted me. So, you know, just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, no, that's, of course, moms, you know, we want to make sure they get their credit due. I can imagine.
Yeah.
And that actually brings me to another point I wanted to talk about with your other article about how you start out and what you learn from failure. And I should back up a little bit because I didn't give a proper introduction about your company, Digitarian, which started back in 1997, and it's really grown now. So maybe you can just give us a little bit about your company, where you are, where you came from, where you are now, and then talk about that failure that you learned. Again, another thing of what you saw that people would pay for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. You know, Digitari started off in 1997 as a professional services firm specifically focused around, you know, user experience work for large brands. So, for example, companies like Sony would hire us to come in and say, help us rethink about our Sony.com website, or help us think about, you know, our, you know, Best Western would come to us and say, help us think about BestWestern.com. So we had a very niche boutique firm, very focused on high-end, basically, website design. And then from there, we bought a technology company. So not only were we just designing sites, we were building them. And then at that point, we decided, hey, let's get into the data business. Because what we realized was there's a need for data, and then we added a marketing component in, right? So now clients are saying, hey, we have a great website, but how do we get people there? So then we added a marketing component. What's unique about Digitari is kind of wrapped around that whole thing is around how do we fundamentally bring digital into the real world. So we're actually starting to work on everything from in-car vehicle work. So Hyundai is a client of ours, and we're actually doing work, you know, in the dashboard, connecting it to a mobile device, and we're experimenting on new things, or working with large brands that are saying, help me think about new products I want to take to market, either a, you know, mobile health watch, and we're actually working on the device. So I think Digitari today, if I had to describe it, is a full-service, you know, digital marketing technology and data firm all wrapped in a world of innovation. And we live online. I mean, that's where our business lives. And so we recently, you know, I built a company up, acquired a bunch of business over the last 15 years, and essentially sold the company, and I still run it today, but sold it to the largest marketing services firm in the world called WPP. And WPP owns the top ad agencies in the world. So Ogilvy and Mather and J. Walter, every big name you hear on Mad Men is pretty much owned by WPP today. So anyway, so now I'm part of, you know, a large conglomerate, you know, with over 150,000 employees. And I would say that Digitari continues to grow. We're at 300 plus people. We have offices all over the country, and we're going to continue to expand overseas. So it's been a fun story. I've had a chance to go from entrepreneurship to selling to a multinational, and I've cried, I've smiled, I've hugged, I've been through the entire spectrum. And so I think your original question, which is going back to kind of, you know, failure, you know, I started off as a very young kid where in my neighborhood, I used to dress up as Evel Knievel because I loved Evel Knievel. And what I would do was I would actually set up, you know, cans, and I would jump over the garbage cans. But what was interesting is that I got to a point where I would never make it through. But because I would never make it through, everybody continued to come. And then what happened one day, someone said, hey, Dan, will you jump over? If you jump over five cans, I'll pay you. But I knew that there's no way I could jump over five cans. But I ended up getting an audience of like 20 people to watch me essentially fail. So at that point in time, I realized, you know, that, wow, people are willing to pay money to actually watch you fail. And I think that at a very early age, I put myself in situations where I knew I couldn't win. I would play basketball with people that were, you know, eight times older than I was. I would try to do things I knew that I couldn't win. But by losing so much, I learned how to become a better loser and then ultimately become a better winner.
That is not the usual course where people would think to go that direction, but that's crazy. I love that story about the people paying you to what an epiphany you had at such a young age that really then stuck with you in what you went into business with innovation. So what would you, the other article now you just talked about for graduating class of 2013 graduates.
Yeah.
And you said they need to know digital. What did you mean by that?
You know, I think the reality is, You know, and we believe this as a company, digital is just integrating into the everyday lives of ourselves. I mean, the role that your mobile phone is playing today, or even the example of us being on kind of Blog Talk Radio, or, you know, the role that, you know, the digitization of your car vehicles, or you're seeing touch screens, you're seeing devices, you're seeing Nike, you know, Nike Plus, you're seeing fuel, you're seeing, the point being is that technology is starting to integrate into our everyday life, and it's important that young students understand that, because it's fundamentally transforming businesses as well as business models. You know, the speed in which technology is going to change our lives is going to move at a speed that I think a lot of people just aren't prepared to understand. I mean, if you look at, for example, 3D printing, okay? So I don't know if you follow the trend in 3D printing, but I'm watching it very closely, because if we as consumers essentially became personal manufacturers. So Tamara, if you got to the point where you actually became a personal manufacturer, you manufactured, say, wine glasses, and you made it out of your home, and you all of a sudden needed a distribution channel, so then you created a website, and then you created a mobile phone, and then you said, you want to know something? I'm going to actually go and bring it to a touchscreen eBay store that sits on Madison Avenue, and I want to buy space there. All of a sudden, you change the way we purchase, we communicate, we connect. And I think that if as a graduate student, they grew up in the world of digital, they've been connected. And I think understanding how to harness that and leverage that into your future is really, really important.
Yeah, that's funny that you talked about. We did have about a year ago, I think, on our Trend On show, a guest with 3D printing. And I actually went down and met, and so because I had a business idea that could utilize the 3D printing, so I went down and watched that process and learned and how that just that technology alone can bring things from overseas back to manufacturing in the U.S. and what's possible, and then you just set up your distribution center through your online presence. So that totally all made sense, what you just said, at least to me.
Yeah, I think that's just the beginning, and I think that, you know, I think that there's going to be a huge shift from actually being connected to being disconnected. So the other thing I think in terms of trends is going to be a big push in wellness and fitness and health. Because if you look at obesity rates, if you look at, you know, kind of people are starting to understand what it is they're putting in their body more. We're getting more educated as a society about what we're putting in our bodies. And I think there's going to continue to be a huge shift for people to what I call going a digital fast. They're going to have this huge need to disconnect, because I think digital, there's a lot of data around neuroscience and how it's changing our behaviors. And I think it's creating a tremendous amount of anxiety and stress because we're wired all the time. So I think that there's going to be another movement where these young kids coming out of college can get involved with, which is essentially being disconnected and how to disconnect. So I think there's going to be two sides of the spectrum.
So for the young, what do you see if so? I'm not saying this very well. For kids now, so they're going to have different opportunities than what you had. But what would be some of the same things that you found true back when you were in your 20s and starting out that would be maybe those business principles that are still true today?
People buy from people they like. I tell people, you know, look around you. You know, ask questions of your friends. Ask them about why they like you. You know, why do they spend time with you? You know, people that you've worked with before, people that have people be highly critical of yourself. Because I think, you know, number one, people buy from people they like. People hire people they like. When I think about our interviews, you know, at the end of the day, everybody checks out on resume, right? So I bring 20 young kids in, and we live – so keep in mind, our average age is 27 years old at Digitari. So I've been 27 years old since I was 23 years old. You know what I mean? I've always stayed in this kind of, you know, millennial generation that's always been a millennial generation for me at the age of 27, even though I've gotten older. And I think that the one thing I see consistently is that everybody checks out. You know, everyone goes to good schools, great universities. They all excel. At the end of the day, who has the social skills? Who ultimately fits into our culture? Who ultimately do we want to spend time with? And I think that everybody, I see so many candidates that look so great on paper, but at the end of the day, that interview is really critical. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is you got to show an impact. You have to show how you can impact an organization. I think we live in a world where entrepreneurship is going to continue to be pushed, And I think that because of the speed in which companies are evolving, and I think that you as an individual and as a young student coming into the world have got to show and differentiate yourself as being a leader and being an entrepreneur, even though you're an intrapreneur within an organization. So those are a couple of things I think never change.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because I have a bunch of social kids who are kind of free thinkers, so I'm going to pass along this interview to them and say, hey, pay attention to this.
Well, the truth is we live in a social economy today, mm-hmm. right? So the number one skill you need is to be social and be connected, because we live in a social economy.
And I love that, because I'm a social person, so I'm thrilled that things caught up to where I've been. In high school, when it, back in my day, it was like, okay, you talk too much. I'm like, yes, but I like talking. Here I am today. So that when you mentioned about the corporate culture, I also wanted to talk about that, because that was one of the other articles you wrote that got my attention, because of I follow Mad Men for the fashion. Now, you took it, and I've written some articles about that. You took it from the business perspective of the merger. So tell us a little bit about that with your experience and what advice you gave in terms of a merger and corporate culture.
I mean, I think a couple things, you know, not to go verbatim off the article, but I think that, you know, corporate culture is incredibly delicate. You know, it's like any relationship. You know, if you work at it, you get stronger. If you don't, you get disconnected. And, you know, one of the things I find recently, just kind of further an example of corporate culture is that, I'd say about 6 months ago, you know, as we've continued to grow, so now Digitari has gone in a huge growth spurt. And one of the things that we're trying to do is regulate each office to not have more than 130 employees. The reason why is because at 130 in a services company, you start getting disconnected. And what I ended up doing on top of it, because of our company, it's changing so quickly. We're starting to do more product development, more marketing, we're just the company's evolving. And one of the things I did is I left my office. I had this gorgeous view of the ocean and beautiful view of the bay, and I decided to leave my office. And one of the reasons I decided to do that is because I wanted to continue to not lose my culture. And the only way to do that is to be in it and to really, really be in it. So what I do is every 2 weeks I move to another area of the business. So one day I'm sitting next to a tech guy, one day I'm sitting next to a PhD guy, one day I'm sitting next to a designer. And I said, you move around. And now I'm kind of a homeless guy in my own office, to be honest with you. I'm a wanderer. I'm a wanderer in my own office. I don't have a desk. I don't have a home, and I just kind of wander. And what I found is when you get past your own insecurities as an individual, where you always feel like you need to be in an office, and you actually end up kind of leaving it, and you end up standing, I think, kind of naked in front of your employees, meaning that they can see everything you're doing because we have a very open space, so they can hear me talk, they can see my emails, they can see what I'm doing, they can watch me now. So you put yourself on stand. And I think what that does is all of a sudden it inspires people that I'm willing to be where they're at. And I think when that happens, that starts impacting corporate culture. So to me, corporate culture is an everyday thing. It never ends. So we do everything from events. We do everything from massages. We do everything in the office. We do everything to fitness, basketball events, social events. And one of the most important things that we've done is we do a lot of nonprofit work. And I think that it's really important in today's kind of economy that you have to give back. You have to show social responsibility. And one of the things that we all did as an organization is we got involved with a school called the Monarch School. The Monarch School is a school created here in San Diego for homeless children. And Digitari is helping and responsible for marketing and telling the story around Monarch School, helping fundraising, helping marketing, essentially doing a lot of in-kind donation. And I find through the years, we've been involved with a lot of major nonprofit efforts. And I think that in any company, especially a youthful one, one of the number one traits you find in a younger generation is giving back. And if you're not giving back, it has a major impact on your corporate culture. So I think, I mean, these are just little stories I'm giving you, but I think corporate culture is everything. Without corporate culture, you have nothing, really, honestly.
Well, and that's a good lead-in for our next guest and why I thought the two of you would pair so well, because Mark Papadas, our guest coming up on the second half of the show, has really devoted his experience to building a nonprofit for kids that has that social responsibility. And I do think, I agree that the mindset, especially of the younger generation coming up, having just raised a bunch of them, they're very social and globally responsible. And it's almost like they think it's a negative if you're not. Like, how can you not be that way? Because it's just intrinsic in their mindset. So I think those are great things. I was going to say, when you were talking about the transparency, that maybe you could teach our government a little bit about that transparency issue.
Well, I think that's being found about every day, right? I mean, you know, transparency is, your point is really important, but you know, you're never going to, you know, listen to me, you're never going to be, not everyone's going to be 100% transparent. There's some things we got to keep to ourselves, because everything else is going to be exposed, trust me. I mean, it's just, yeah. You know, you got to learn how to keep some things yourself, because, you know, we live in a world that, you know, there's so much data around each and every one of us. So it's an interesting time, and I think socially, obviously, giving back is really critical.
Yeah. And the other thing that I liked, the takeaway from that article from the Mad Men on the merger, is that as businesses grow and go through that change, that there's going to be challenges, and some will do it successfully, and you gave ways and examples of how to do that better, and there are some that are going to fail, and then what you learn from that. But it's akin to a marriage, that just because some marriages end in divorce doesn't mean that the marriage is a bad idea in the first place. And so there are ways for companies to go through growth and do it successfully.
I think if you, by not trying, I think the most important thing, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. And I think that's a saying that's been going on for a while. I mean, that's a saying. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you have to try. And I think if you're not trying, then you're not going to accomplish your full potential. And I think that every day, you know, my biggest fear in life, every day I wake up, is I'm afraid of not trying. Right? It's my biggest fear. It's not about failing. It's about not trying. Because I know that if I'm not trying, I'm never going to learn how to win. I'm never going to learn how to succeed, because therefore I'm not failing enough. So I think that to me is really important. Try to put yourself in very uncomfortable situations. And I think that when you do that and people find their way through it, you know, it's amazing the gratification you get when you. So I fundamentally believe in the human spirit. I believe that the human spirit is the most powerful thing we have as individuals. And if you can tap into that, it becomes unbelievable. And we've been able to do that and be successful simply by bringing bright people together with a great corporate culture and tapping into the human spirit of people.
Well, I cannot wrap up the segment with you any better said than that. So thank you for joining us. If people want to find out more about you and Digitaria and your LinkedIn influence articles and things like that, where would they get a hold of you?
Well, I mean, you can email me to dan@digitaria.com. You can go to digitaria.com to learn more about the company. And to connect with me, you can go to linkedin.com/influencers, INFLUNCERS. So those are all the different ways to get a hold of me, or you can just search for Dan Cobby and give me a ring, or just give me a shout out and I'll respond. So I'm pretty available.
Yes, you are, and I want to thank you for being available today as our guest on Tamerlee's Friend On. You did me a great honor by spending your time with us, and I hope that the rain burns off by the sun and you'll be back to blue skies in a few hours there, although you probably need the rain.
No, and thank you so much. It was a real pleasure, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Dan. Have a good one.
You too. Thank you.
Okay, and now we will have, usually we have on Tamerlee's Trend On a fashion minute, but I don't want to take up more time than we can have with Mark coming up, because very important information and great content there. So I will just mention for fashion minute that this past Monday I had the opportunity to be on Real Milwaukee on Fox 6 here, a local morning show, with Get Fit for Father's Day with a well-fitting shirt, suit, and pants. And so there's a link I will post on my blog page that you can watch that clip, or you can just Google Real Milwaukee Fit for Father's Day. and some tips on what to get for Dad. We're offering a special with J. Hilburn Custom Luxury Menswear right now where you can get a gift certificate for Dad, a $75 gift certificate for $100, a $100 gift certificate for $75. So you can contact me also for more information about that. And for Father, one of the things that's a changing trend in menswear is that men are more defining their style. They're personalizing and customizing their wardrobe as an expression of who they are. And so that's a trend we want to embrace. And there are many ways of doing that, whether it's color or detailing. Like on a custom shirt, you can get a color thread that'll just pop or personalize an outfit or match with your company logo colors or your alma mater team. So things like that. There's ways to customize and personalize your wardrobe. All about the details. So check that out. So now we want to bring on our show, our next guest with Mark Papadas. As I said, he is the founder of I Am for Kids and speaker, author, and business sales professional trainer and coach. So, Mark, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us. And we had Mark on Trend on a month or so ago with a group from Engaging Speakers out of Chicago. And each speaker on that segment talked a little bit about their individual speaking and business and areas of expertise. And the hour went so fast, and I felt like there was so much more I wanted to talk about with each one of you. So we invited Mark to come back and share in greater length about his I Am for Kids. So, Mark, why don't you give us a little bit about your background, and then we can go from there.
Well, sure. First off, thanks for having me today. And as far as my background is concerned, my business background started off at college. I was working in a sales position, and I've always been a glutton for information. I've always been that type of person who reads and listens, but not necessarily for entertainment. I can't tell you the last novel that I read, but I'm always reading somebody like a Brian Tracy or Tony Robbins or Zig Ziglar, people like that. And I started a career as a sales trainer. I've started and led national sales organizations, trained people, got them up and running, got them promoted, et cetera. And then I decided to take that on the road, so to speak, and actually do that for myself and start to train people outside of the companies that I was then employed with. And had a really nice sales training practice that said I got to travel all over the world and train people all over and really get them up and running and get them going with their businesses. And about 3 years ago, I had my epiphany moment. Not that I didn't love and enjoy what I was doing, but I realized that I was put on this earth to teach a lot of those same skills that I was teaching adults, whether it be from their identity or their means of effectively communicating. But those same things that I was teaching to adults were so much more important and would have so much more of an impact if I was able to take them to children, so that they could have them mastered by the time that they get into high school and college, so that when they hit the quote-unquote real world, that they'll already be a step ahead of the game.
So it was just 3 years ago that you started I Am for Kids.
Right. It was, and if you want, I can take a minute or two and tell you the story of really kind of how it happened. But, you know, first off, I have three children of my own. And the things that I teach in I Am for Kids, I've been teaching not only to my children since they've been old enough to hear my voice, not understand me, but literally just to hear my voice since they were infants. I've been talking to them about it and communicating with them. And I also coach youth sports year-round. And there's not a season that went by where one of the parents would come over and say, like, you know, what did you do with Bobby? He's a different kid. He's so much more confident and, you know, things of that nature. And so I'd been teaching and been working with kids, and I've always had this unique gift of being able to communicate with kids. Even though I celebrated my 49th birthday at the end of last week, even though I'm quote-unquote an old man according to my kids, I can still have that connection with young people, and I don't know why it is, but I've learned not to fight it and just embrace it. And so it was October of 2009, when I was actually just out with a couple friends and we were talking, and I did what we all do, but nobody ever admits to, where you're having a conversation with somebody and you kind of mentally check out and you start thinking about something else, and then you realize that you had checked out and you checked back into the conversation, right? And what happened was he was actually saying some really positive things about my son, who at the time was 8 years old. And he was one of his football coaches, and he was just going on and on about what a great kid my son was and what a leader he was. And where I checked out was kind of right about that point, and I started thinking to myself, I was like, wouldn't it be great if every parent could have these conversations about their kids? And what could I do about that? And then that's when I realized that, like I said, I wasn't listening, so I kind of reengaged. So later that night, I went home, I had gotten into bed, and I was at that stage of sleep before you hit REM, and that's when literally everything came to me. I mean, if you were sitting next to me right now, you'd see I have goosebumps just kind of thinking back to that time. Because I literally sat up in bed, wide awake, and I went downstairs and got out a legal pad and started writing. And it was like a stream of consciousness type of thing, to where it just kept coming and coming and coming, and how it would be, how it would be structured, what the characters were like, their strengths and weaknesses, the whole thing literally came to me that night in about an 8-hour period. It was funny because my wife came downstairs the next morning, kind of rubbing her eyes, and she's like, "Have you been down here all night?" And I'm like, "Shh. I'm on a roll. Quiet."
Yes, I have.
So that's kind of how it all came about. And then I sought out some experts that were, I'll be the first to tell you, I don't have any letters after my name. I'm not even a college graduate, but I get a PhD in results. And I went out to these people who were the experts in their fields and asked them to better it, to poke holes in it. How can we make it work better? And they advised me, but about 80% of what is I Am for Kids today came from that night where I had my epiphany. And I stopped my sales training practice literally that night. I made my decision that I have found my mission, and this is what I was put on the earth to do, and this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Well, that is exciting. And with I could understand what you were saying about that with the kids. My background, growing up, I worked my summers at a Christian camp up in northern Wisconsin, and there was an ability to see, even as a young high school counselor, when you could connect with a younger kid and they just gravitated towards you and you could change that. And that's something that I carried with me, and then spending years in education and just my own kids, and how powerful it is. I tend to have a heart as well for that kid who's, no, nobody says hi to, and I know I've gone out of my way at points of time to, I'm just going to smile at that kid every day when I pass him in the hallway, or just talk to him or engage him and find out what he likes. And you were able to take something that, on a small level, and make it so that it would have much wider reach and greater impact. So how did you put the I Am for Kids program together, and then how do you implement that into the classrooms?
The concept behind it was, one of the things that I've always been a firm believer in is that the most important possession, and I know that's probably not the right use of the word, but the most important possession is your character, is your identity. And when I say your identity, I don't mean your social security number or anything like that. I'm talking about how you finish your statement of I am dot, dot, dot. And the scary thing is that most people, adults and kids, have never given any thought to that question. So, for example, I used to do a program for adults based on the same 5-step process that I invented. And the first thing that we do is we give both kids and adults, we get a blank sheet of paper that says I am on the top of it, and we ask them to finish that thought. And immediately, once again, whether it's kids or adults, hands go up. How do you want me to answer this? What are you looking for? It's like, just finish the thought. There's no right or wrong answer. Just do it however you think you should. Now, for example, with adults, a little over 70% of the time, they finish that thought with their name and or their occupation, right? Neither of it has anything to do with who they are, their belief system, the standards they hold themselves to, et cetera. Now, when we did the pilots and the pilot classrooms for the kids program, that's where we really, where my eyes were really opened wide, was that, anybody who knows kids, if you ask them a question, they always answer with one word, okay? So we kind of expected that. But what really scared us was that a little over half the time, it was like 50.2%, a little over half the time they answered with that one-word answer that was a negative trait or characteristic. It's like some of the actual answers were, I'm fat, I'm stupid, I'm ugly. there was one that was I am unlovable. Now, because it was anonymous, right, we don't have them put their names on it because it doesn't matter what their name is. It matters who they think they are. I don't know what kid that was, but that's one that just kind of socks you right in the gut, you know, and says, you know, we've really got to do this, and we cannot fail at taking this out to where it needs to be. So, you know, like when people ask me to describe what is AIM for Kids, the simple way that most people seem to get it is like to say it's kind of like Tony Robbins meets Charlie Brown. You know, we teach those personal development skills, those identity building skills, in a way that kids understand and can interact with and actually enjoy doing. So when we started thinking about the process of, okay, how can we get this to the most kids? Where do kids have to go every day? They have to go to school. So let's make it in a program that would be effective to be used in classrooms. So we built it to fit on top of the curriculum that is taught in the public schools in second through fifth grade classrooms. And we specifically chose second through fifth grade because that is the time when the majority of the development of this part of the brain is happening. So, you know, we eventually will have I wouldn't say so much a product line, but you will have programs that will go from toddlers up to adults. But we said if we're going to focus on one area, let's get the second through fifth grade so that we can really start to have an impact as these kids start to go through, get into middle school. Because middle school is usually when they have to face some of their toughest choices. For the most part, even in the nastiest neighborhoods, until you hit about 11, 12 years old, the kids are pretty much left alone except for, you know, by accident. You know, they're not actually actively recruited into the gangs and that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's why we chose that particular area and why we chose schools. So we made it so that it sat on top of the curriculum so that it could integrate into multiple different classes, subjects that are taught in the schools. And the other thing we had to think about was, okay, well, we know what schools' budgets are like these days. So what can we do to make it as inexpensive as possible for the schools? And that's when we came up with our business model of having it be corporately sponsored. So the beautiful thing about this is if there's a school who wants it, it literally does not cost them a penny. All they have to do is sign a letter of intent. It's not a contract because there's no exchange of money. They sign a letter of intent that says that, you know, we want to implement the I Am for Kids program in our school. My team then goes out and finds the corporate sponsorships. So they don't even have to go out and do a fundraiser or a bake sale or anything like that to raise the money to put the program in. My team does that for them. And in exchange for that, the corporate sponsors are able to get a number of, what they refer to as impressions. So there's, you know, there's letters that go home to the, to the parents, et cetera. There's posters that we send to the school that, you know, say, hey, we're implementing I Am for Kids, and this ABC school was sponsored by Ace Hardware or, you know, Joe's Plumbing or McDonald's. You know, we are actively talking to national corporations about sponsoring literally thousands of schools at a time, and that's where we are right now. So that's kind of how it all came about and how it all works. And the transformation in some of these kids that we've seen is just amazing when they go through the process and they actually anchor that identity into their body using the science behind the whole mind-body connection. When we see some of these kids that were just kind of, you know, slouched over and just had no confidence whatsoever, and you see them afterwards, and we go back and we find that, you know, we haven't been around long enough, so we can't track test scores, which I know is what, you know, the buzzwords are in education right now. So we can't track that over a long period of time yet because we just haven't been around that long. But what we have seen is immediately the kids go from C students to B students, from B students to A students, and the disciplinary actions have almost been completely eliminated because they can actually remind each kid of, you know, basically, are they living up to their own standards? Are they being who they, you know, they say that they are, who they claim that they are? And when they do that, kids kind of go back because, once again, they created themselves, so they own it.
I was amazed. Just last month I was substitute teaching at a local district here, and there was one kid, he wanted to take a hall pass and go to his locker, and the other kids, you know, chimed in, which is, you know, kids are funny that way. They're like, no, don't let him do that. He'll, you know, not come back. He'll get into trouble. You know, they already had him, who he was, what his MO was, and kind of told me the deal on him. And I looked at him and I said, you know what, I'm going to trust you that you're going to go to your locker. I'm going to give you 4 minutes. Here's the pass. And I know you can do this. And he looked at me and he's like, really? And I said, yes. I said, now don't disappoint me. And he went and he was back. And it was like, I think the other kids were like, wow, you know, we didn't expect that out of him. And it's like when you empower kids to be their better selves, they want to meet you in that challenge. So I guess I was going to ask on a practical, that's maybe a practical example of how you see that implemented, but how do you take that seemingly intangible of a self-esteem and make it real for these kids?
Well, it's kind of twofold, because one of the things that I found is that, and I'm not a big fan of the term self-esteem, because to me, it's really morphed over the years. To me, what self-esteem has become is feeling good about trying and failing and then giving up. It's like, okay, well, you tried, but good job kind of thing. And to me, that's not what self-esteem is. To me, self-esteem is having, is what we're talking about here, is having that sense of identity, of knowing who you are. And one of the things that I believe about kids in particular is I think there's so many things that adults can learn from kids. Or there's things that we as adults have unlearned, or I think might be the right way to say it. I think that every child is born with everything that they need, all the tools and traits and characteristics they need to be successful in life. It's the things that they adopt from the adults in their lives that keep them from getting there. You know, because to me, the number one trait that anybody needs to be successful in life, and I know Dan covered that when he was talking about it, is persistence. And kids are born with persistence. I mean, when was the last time you saw a kid quit trying to walk? Right? They keep doing. Did they fall down? Did they hurt themselves? Heck yes. But what do? They get back up, right? And they just keep trying and they keep trying until they actually are able to do that. It's their natural instinct to be curious, to grow, to learn. And I think that when they learn to not be curious anymore, when they learn that it's okay to quit going after something that they really want, that's when the horizons of their world start to fold up and become the walls of their box. And once you're in a box, there's really no place to go but in there. And that's where I think society is a lot today, is that we've got so many people in all these little boxes, and they're all just kind of bouncing around in their little boxes next to each other, as opposed to opening up those boxes and then mixing and really becoming what everybody could be.
Do you see that happening at a younger age? I mean, I know it's only been 3 years that you've had the program, but do you see kids at a younger age checking out sooner or disengaging? Or no?
That is one of the things that I have noticed, is that at a younger and younger age, they're not committed. What's the word I'm looking for? That they know that what their path in life is, so to speak, and it's basically what everybody has told them. I think maybe it's probably the best way to explain it. So somebody once asked me. For example, one of my missions right now within the foundation is I'm trying to use the term now, I'm trying to build a board of directors that really matters. In other words, the people who have the connections and the resources to be able to get us to where we want to go as quickly as we can, as opposed to just me and some of my friends who, while we're passionately committed to doing this, don't necessarily have the resources to be able to get to where we want to go right away, right? So one of the people that we're targeting is Christopher Gardner. Not everybody knows that name, but if you saw the movie The Pursuit of Happiness with
mm-hmm.
Will Smith, okay,
uh-huh.
That's Christopher Gardner's story. Okay.
Oh.
And
okay.
So we're actively out approaching, trying to reach him and to get him to come on our board of directors. So somebody once said, well, would you consider your program a success if you had one of the kids who went through it become the next Chris Gardner? And I said, yeah. So that would be fantastic. So do you know what I'd rather have? Is I'd rather have 10,000 or 100,000 go through and be the next Bill Smith. He said, well, who's Bill Smith? He's like, I don't know. But Bill Smith could be the local State Farm agent. He could be the local grocery store owner. He could be anybody. But he's somebody who lives till he's 82, has 4 kids, 12 grandkids, and actually lives a life, because there's parts of, I've been in parts of cities around this country where, depending on what your gender is and the color of your skin, you might be expected to live to your 20. And if you think you're going to die when you're 20 years old, you're going to live your life a completely different way than if you expect to live a long life and have a family and all those types of things. So that's what I would consider a success, is where if we can get tens to hundreds of thousands to millions of kids who actually have a life worth living, as opposed to just living until what they perceive as their, you know, their predestined end at a very young age.
Well, it's that difference of taking ownership of their own lives and creating their own lives, making it what they want it to be rather than passively responding. But kids, unless they're empowered with those skills, they don't know how to do that. And that's one of your books you wrote, 10 Secrets to Empower Kids and Awaken the Child in You. What are just some of those key ones, quick, because we're almost out of time and I want to get to some, you know, your speaking and your books too, so...
No problem. And thank you for mentioning the book. Well, you know, the book is actually a half and half book. Half of it is actually covering the identity process, and it's written for adults to go through with their kids, although kids have read it and have been able to get a lot from it as well. But some of the secrets, they're actually fairly simple. And, you know, one of them, you know, the first one, for example, is more for adults and coaches. I call it Be Great. You know, there's something that I do with all the kids that I work with is every time that I leave them, that we part ways, I always tell them to be great. And then their response is, I am. And it sounds like a simple little thing that sometimes when I first started with the kids, they think it's real silly. But over a period of time, it starts to build those synapses, it builds those connections in the brain to where they do start to think that they are great and that they know that what they're going to do is going to be important and meaningful. Another one is decisions have consequences. That you have to let kids fail and let them experience the, you know, when I say the pain, I'm not necessarily mean physical pain, like if you jumped off of something and you broke a leg, but, you know, that they make a decision that good or bad things can happen, and when bad things happen, that they have to experience those bad things as well. You know, we see that a lot in classrooms to where kids, you know, they tried, or, you know, kids are starting to get grades based on perceived effort as opposed to actually learning some of the material or actually achieving something. And that really does start to play games with kids' brains, because ones who do work hard and do a work, if another kid who worked half as hard and maybe got, you know, four times as many wrong also got an A, it starts to teach them, well, why should I bust my butt? Why should I work hard to achieve something when I can just kind of get by and do that over here? And then there are a few other secrets.
I was going to say, most kids seemingly have that innate sense of justice of what is right and wrong, and they'll call you out on it. So if you're
Absolutely.
Skewing their idea of what's fair, I can see where that would create that shutdown.
Right. They know. And that's the thing that, you know, adults don't give the kids enough credit. They're a lot smarter. They're a lot sharper than most of the adults give them credit for.
So, well, and to all the adult influencers out there, you know, the power of the positive compare and the power of the negative, and while some kids might take a negative and make that their challenge to beat that, for the most part that drives kids down, and the positive really is what helps them to build and create their own identities. We're just about out of time here, Mark, so I want to give you a chance to give a shout out.
Well, you know, first off, if people are interested in my books, 10 Secrets to Empower Kids and Awaken the Child in You, they can do that different ways. It is available on Amazon, or they can go to 10secretsbook.com, and they can get that. They can get it there. Also, if somebody's interested in finding out more about the foundation, or maybe even making a donation or being a volunteer, it's IAM, the number 4. kids.com, so it's www.iam4kids.com, and there's all kinds of information there that they can go through. And basically, I also have a series of kids books that I'm starting to write. The first one is also available on Amazon. It's called The Power to the Pupil Series, and it's a series of books written for kids at second to fifth grade level. There's going to be about 50 of them in total when we get done with everything, and each one is a different empowering word and a true story of a child in that age group living that word, so he's actually becoming a role model for other kids their age.
Great. Okay, so we will also post that on our TrendOn blog site and Link Local Network webpage. So thank you for joining us, and thank you to Dan Cobby also for joining us on today's Tamara Lee's Trend on the Link Local Network with Heidi Feimster. We will be back next week at 10 a.m. Same time, same channel. So thank you, and we look forward to next week. And you can listen to the show archivally, too, if you want to share the link. So thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye, Heidi.
Bye.